The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. We welcome Alex Myers. He's a brand new author, first time author, with his brand new book, Revolutionary. Alex, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And this book is cool. It's about this lady back. Gonna say right even before the country was the United States. And here is this lady. She's going off to join the army, I guess, eh?
That's right. She's an ancestor of mine, so it's a true story, or based, I made up some parts, but it's based on a true story. And it's 1782. It's the end of the Revolutionary War, and you're right, America had just been born.
Wow. Now, you know, it was pretty much against the law, I guess, for a lady at the time to dress up and say that she was a guy?
Absolutely against the law. It was really not even the custom for a woman to travel by herself. So women were property of, they belonged to a man, their father when they were children, their husband when they were married. And Deborah, the heroine of this book, was an indentured servant, so she belonged to her master until she was freed. So women really didn't have much independence at all.
No, I was surprised, even men in the book during this time, indentured servants. How did they become indentured servants? I guess different ways, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Some of them would come over and they'd buy their passage from England or from the continent through an indenture. Deborah's case was pretty typical. She was one of seven children, and her mom just couldn't afford to keep her, and her mother sold her. It's a kind of a form of short-term slavery, and boys would be sold into it. It's kind of like an apprenticeship. It could be very pleasant. It could be useful. It could give you a trade, and it could be horrible as well.
What are the challenges with writing a book during that time? I mean, you probably either are a fan of history, or you really had to do a lot of research.
The latter. I had to do a lot of research. It was fun. I learned a lot. I made a lot of mistakes, and the ones that I made that lasted until the final copy editing, I kept hitting these surprises. For instance, I had them carrying something, so I used the word tote, T-O-T-E. It didn't exist back then, and it wasn't a word that came into existence until it came from the South in 1850s, 1860s, you start to hear it. Little tiny things like that. I had no idea what I was getting into when I started.
Well, you do have a few, I guess, maybe words in here that might take you back to that time also.
Mm-hmm. I tried to get the pattern of speech or the sensibility of the time through a few key words without making everything thee and ye and thou, which I thought would be too much distance for the reader. So I would call it contemporary sounding speech with every now and then sort of a flavor of the time.
Massachusetts, that's where this book takes place during this time, 1780s. Why Massachusetts?
That's where she's from. She was born in Plimpton. She was indentured in Middleborough. In real life, she went down to Bedford, which is now New Bedford. And she tried to enlist in a ship, and then she went up to Boston and tried to sign on as a trade up there. Neither of those worked out, and then she enlisted and marched down to West Point. But she is currently the state heroine of Massachusetts, which is pretty cool.
Really?
She came back to that area of Massachusetts. She came back to Stoughton and Sharon, Massachusetts, after the war, and lived there for the rest of her life.
She was a weaver, in the way that you weave this story, pun intended, I guess. But I guess that's really tough on the hands and kind of a backbreaking work, in a sense.
Yes, I think, and weavers back then, it was a job for both men and women, and you could work in a shop. If you were a man, you could be one of several weavers and almost a sort of mini factory of the time. But for Deborah, she was an itinerant weaver, so she went house to house. Looms were huge. They were the size of a double bed. You had to be pretty rich to afford one because you had to have a place to put it. And you'd also have looms in what were called public rooms of taverns where you could go and you could rent it out, or someone would rent it for you and you would weave there. It was tiring. I think you were sitting, you were cramped, you were staring at a very finely textured surface for a long period of time, and you were working intensely with your fingers. You know, I think once you got to be middle-aged or older, it would be awfully hard work.
And that's where Deborah was at. She was at a tavern.
Yes, exactly. And I set that accurately, historically. Sproat Tavern was on the green, or in the center of Middleborough. There wasn't a green. There were looms and there were wheels there. What were called, we think of a spinning wheel as sort of a small affair, but there were larger ones called walking wheels that you had to walk to move. They were huge. And so women would gather in taverns, in the public rooms and weave and spin there.
You know what I liked about, in the book Revolutionary in the Tavern? I think you hit it right. I mean, there was a lot of cider, more probably hard cider than beer.
Yes, absolutely. Beer, I think, was, you could get it. Wine was really for the upper classes. And cider was what the average person, men and women, drank, and they drank it every meal, every day.
You know, that's kind of cool because it's making a comeback, I think, especially with major breweries. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go to the store right now where you maybe couldn't a few years ago, but you can buy hard cider.
I think it's the gluten-free craze is might be part of why you're seeing cider nowadays, but that definitely was not the case back then. They would eat gluten, no problem.
With the book Revolutionary, my question is, Deborah becomes a soldier. Mm-hmm. She finally enlists, and you use the word Deborah in there, which I liked, just because I think if you used her other name, we would have been going back and forth. And did you do that because, you know, so the reader wouldn't get lost like me?
Yeah, I think it's for two reasons. I think it's to prevent the reader from getting lost, but also to express her identity. She shifts gradually over the course of the story from Deborah to Robert. And I think it would be too much to say that the day she decided she was going to sign on, boop, that was it. She was Robert. Not at all. I think as a person who in my own life has moved from one gender to another, it takes time. It takes comfort. It takes, self-awareness and belief that you can do this. And so early on in her enlistment, she's very much still Deborah, and she's very worried that she's going to be discovered. She'll say the wrong thing. She'll do the wrong thing. I think it's like any disguise that you put on. If you're trying to be something you're not, or rather you're trying to be something that you haven't been before, it's hard at first.
Tell me about the army that she enlisted in. I mean, it's the new and improved army, huh?
Yeah, it is not the army of Valley Forge. I think sometimes when we imagine the American Revolution, we think of our founding fathers, and then we think of the first really hard winters of the war. Deborah was serving in 1782, and General Washington in the spring of that year put out a call for recruits, and nobody answered, which I think not many people realize. Most Americans at the time, most colonials, were against the idea of a national standing army. They really feared it. They didn't want it. They thought it was going to be a potentially upsetting force in politics. And so they didn't want to send their sons off. And their sons, or brothers or husbands had already served. They'd served in the militia usually. And they had no interest in signing on for three years. So the army, when she joined it, was volunteer, or people who wanted to be there. They didn't have to enlist. There was no draft. And they were paid. These towns had to get up huge bounties to convince men to go and serve. And that's probably what made her want to serve, is she could get £60 for signing on. That's probably, I'd guess, 2 or even 3 years worth of wages for her.
Really?
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
Wow. So, and you know, not only that, but during that time, didn't somebody that maybe was of wealth, of upper class, if they didn't want to serve, they could have somebody take their place?
Absolutely. And if you were indentured servant and your master was called to serve, he could send you instead. There were a lot of people who, of the very, very low classes, who found that to be either required of them or economically advantageous to go serve.
What a day in the army if you were going someplace. I'm sure you'd just probably hop in maybe that Humvee and you'd go in a caravan or maybe a plane to another base. What was the mode of travel like back then?
On foot. They had, when Deborah was serving, they weren't using the heavy munitions anymore. But when you used cannon, earlier in the war, there were big carts to pull it, and oxen or horses to pull those carts. Cavalry units had horses. Deborah was in the light infantry, so she was on foot all the time. There's a lot of marching.
Hartford, Connecticut. They go pretty much around there. The sergeant that's taking them to West Point, they get to see things that they haven't seen before. I think that maybe the whole group, what, maybe about 30 people that they had, mm-hmm. Going around the big city of Hartford. How big of a city would a big city be back then?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure how many people were living in Boston or Hartford at the time. Manhattan was still occupied by the British, but even that I don't think was the largest city. I believe Philadelphia was larger. I think we're talking in the terms of thousands of people, but I really don't know. It was quite a bit bigger than Middleborough.
West Point, of course. What was West Point like back then? Did you do much research on that?
I did. It was actually hard to find information on that. You could get a good map of Philadelphia, Manhattan, Boston. I even found some decent maps of roads in Massachusetts, but West Point, boy, there was not much. I had maps of their fortifications right along the Hudson, the great chain that they would raise if they thought the British fleet was going to sail up. But as to where the soldiers stayed, it was really hard to find out. You could find out where the officers stayed. There were mansions and houses that they built. There's some remains of barracks, but a lot of the stuff that the soldiers lived in was tents and huts and little lean-tos that would have been taken down almost immediately after the de-garrisoning. So I tried to make it as accurate as I could, but it was very limited resources there.
Alex, Revolutionary, your brand new book. I mean, you do a great job of bringing the people in. You suck them right in, even with that very first chapter. A storyteller all your life?
I grew up around storytellers. Both my parents tell great stories, and my brother as well. So we were always just a chatty, kind of conversational family. And I think I've always enjoyed listening to good stories and then being able to tell them as well.
When you bring a book like this to life, what do you do?
Well, you have to write it first. And in this case,
that's important.
Yeah, that's a big step. In this case, research was also important. But usually for me, bringing a book to life is just a matter of getting my butt in the chair, or I like to stand to write. So just putting my hands on the pen and the paper and pouring it out, you know, just trying to see where it goes, where it leads you. And then the less fun part, I think, is the revision. And then the harder part is actually taking it from when you think it's ready to bring it to the rest of the world. So.
And probably, you know, you take it to an editor and they either whittle it down or they say it needs this or that. What's that like for an author? I mean, this is your baby.
It is. Yep. I think if you have the right editor, it's a great opportunity. I had two very good editors at Simon & Schuster, and both of them worked me hard at times, but you could tell they loved the story as much as I did. So, for instance, when I first wrote it, I actually worked on it with my agent before we submitted it to editors, and she said, you got to cut the start. So, okay, cut the first 100 pages. I said, good to go. All right, great. Send it to the editors, sell it. The first editor says, you have to cut the start. I was like, I already cut 100 pages off of it. Nope, 90 pages needs to go. So cut 90 pages. And now take that 90 pages that you cut and rewrite it into 30 pages. So it was activities like that, which were challenging, but there was no doubt I would at first sort of curse them and say, oh, I don't want to do this. But then by the time I was midway through the revisions, I'd start to see this is going to make it a lot better. They were much smarter than I was.
So if the pages were in Revolutionary and not taken out, what would the feel of this book be like?
I think it began in its first form with a much longer runway before she takes off and joins the army. I really was intrigued as a researcher about what her life was like in Middleborough. I didn't know anything about that time, and I wanted to give the reader a sense of what I had discovered, of what it was like to be an indentured servant, of what it was like to be a single woman who supported herself. She probably was one of two or three people in the town of Middleborough who was a single woman who supported herself, and she might have been the only one to do that who wasn't a widow. So she really was a remarkable woman, and I wanted to give the readers the feel of what created pressure in her life, as well as where she had some sense of freedom and some sense of self, and why she would want to run away. Why would she would risk everything to become a soldier?
Alex, I wanted to kind of switch gears here just a little bit, if I may. A transgender author. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So I was born a girl. I grew up in rural Maine, and I think I grew up in a place and a time where it was, as opposed to Deborah, a little bit more acceptable to be what we call a tomboy. That's a term that didn't exist in her time. I was sort of rough and tumble, had an older brother, spent a lot of time with him, and then when I was 17, I came out as transgender. And what that means is that I began to live as a man, and I have lived as a man ever since then. Being an author as transgender, I think, is no different than being any other sort of author. And I both tried to bring my identity and my sense of self to the page, as well as leave it A little bit in the margins. So by that, I mean, I think a lot of the time in the novel, when Deborah is feeling, you know, unsure of whether she passes as a man or unsure of how to act in order to be a man, I tried to draw on my own experience of that. When I was 17 and first living as a man, I wondered, was I walking right? Was I talking right? If people gave me, you know, a second glance, I'd say, oh, do I not look enough like a guy? So I tried to put some of that in, but I also tried to keep a lot of my own experience out because I came out in 1995. And at that point in time, transgender was a term that meant something. It was an somewhat accepted category. It's become more accepted since then. Deborah didn't have any of that, and she wouldn't have even thought of herself necessarily in terms of having a gender identity. So I wanted to be very careful to not make her me and to not make her transgender, but it definitely informed a lot of the writing.
Yeah, well, I thought that, you know, you bringing her out like that. In your book, you're doing the same thing, which really brings it right to life. I mean, it really pops, which is great.
Yeah, there was one instance, I think other people who are transgender would relate. I think the first time I went to a restaurant and a waitress said, "What can I get you to eat, young man?" And I was just so happy, you know, somebody I don't know thinks I'm a guy. And there's a scene early on when she's just started to run away and she helps a farmer whose cart is stuck. And he says, you know, "Thank you, lad." And she's just delighted. And so little things like that where I felt like there might be a similarity of pleasure or dismay or fear or anger, I tried to use my own life story.
Of course, an advocate for transgenders, I mean, going way back, I'm sure there was a lot of racism over that. How has that changed any? Or?
It has. I think that more and more people have heard the term and know something of what it means. There have been some celebrities who are transgender. And back when I came out, there was almost no legal protection for folks who were transgender. And now more and more cities and towns and even states have gender identity as a protected class, which is important because people do lose their jobs over this. There's a lot of ambiguous legal terrain in terms of some states let you change your birth certificate and other states don't. Some states, you know, some people have an easier time if they pass well, if they don't. Some medical insurance companies cover surgery or hormones and others don't. So it's widely varying depending on who you are, how you want to live, and where you live as to what rights and protections you have. And I've tried over the years to be, I would not call myself an activist, but I would certainly call myself an advocate of transgender rights. And through writing and teaching and speaking, just getting out there as a public face of this is what it means to be transgender. And from the time when I was a student at Harvard, I thought it was really important to show I look normal, I have a job, I'm happily married for 11 years, and, you know, I'm a normal person. And in this case, being boring is radical. So I'm happy to do that.
There you go. Well, revolutionary, of course, your first book, I'm sure that you've got ideas maybe for a second book. Usually when I talk to authors, they're like, well, you know, the second one's almost finished. How about yourself?
Yep, it is done and ready to sell.
All right, well, revolutionary, of course, it is a historical novel. You're kind of digging that, or are you looking at maybe more of a contemporary type thing?
The second one is much more contemporary, but I have to say that I will definitely try to another historical topic in the future. I had so much fun with the research, and it's a real challenge to both evoke the past, but make it accessible for a contemporary reader.
Well, can I ask a little bit about what the next book is without giving too much away, because I don't want to do that.
Sure. It is a contemporary story, a kind of coming of age for a young transgender guy. So it keeps some of the gender identity themes, but it's set in modern America.
Okay, probably like 2013 or so?
A little bit earlier than that, but yeah, roughly.
Okay. So you have a year when maybe that took place?
When it took place?
Yes.
I would say right around 2000.
Okay. Yep. So things have changed quite radically, I guess, even from today, from the year 2000.
For sure.
You probably had to do a little research on that just to make sure that probably in 2000 there wasn't an iPhone or,
that's right,
you know, massive quick computers or anything. I don't remember.
Yeah, it is amazing how much technology has changed and how we communicate. You know, there was an era when you made cell phone calls and now you text, and so you have to get all that right. Otherwise, it doesn't have the verisimilitude that readers want. And people want if you mention a car, you want to mention the model, and you have to make sure that you have it accurate. And believe me, if you don't get it accurate, someone will tell you about it. And it better be a copy editor and not a reader.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, revolutionary, of course, this is out right now. It's out brand new, I guess, huh?
Yep.
So what are you hearing from readers? I'm sure people are emailing you, or you hear, if you have a Twitter account, which I'm sure you do, what are you hearing?
I've heard from a fair number of people who have found it to be page-turning, which is always nice to hear. They get into the story. A lot of people asking me, the most common question is, so what parts are true and what parts are fiction? Which is an interesting question to answer, because there's a lot of both in the novel, and it's sometimes hard to separate them. People really, really curious about who this woman was, and again, how much of the story that I tell is true, and whether I thought she was. The second most common question that I've encountered is, do I think that Deborah was transgender? And my answer to that is no. And then people ask sort of random questions that interested them along the way. There's a lot of people who get into the historical aspect of it, but a lot of people, I think, and this is how I am as a reader, they want to know, well, what happens after the book ended? And so they say, well, what happens when she got home? How'd she meet her husband? You know, why did she marry? Why didn't she run away? And those are questions sometimes that I have answers to, but a lot of time I don't know. So it's fun to converse with readers about what might have been, or why did this happen questions.
Revolutionary, of course, a standalone book, but do you see yourself going back and revisiting Deborah in maybe a different way, maybe earlier, maybe later?
Certainly a book could be written about her later life, because she had a remarkable second kind of career. She married, she had children, and then she did something that's extraordinary. She was the first traveling woman lecturer in America, and she went on the road. She gave a kind of pre-written speech, and then she would go off stage, take off her dress, put on her military uniform, and get on stage with a musket and perform the manual exercise of arms, the drill she learned at West Point. So she was, I think, almost could lay claim to America's first drag show as well. Really, really remarkable woman. And I think you could easily look at that in a short story, or you could look at that in a novel. For now, I think I'm done with Deborah, and I want to try new things, but I think I would return to her at some point in time, perhaps. One never knows.
With a historical novel, you might have had letters and other things. You could really do the research on her. Maybe your family had letters also and knowledge. But, you know, there's a lot of in between, and you have to fill in the gaps. Mm-hmm. How tough is that?
Well, that's where it's fun as a writer. It's fun to fill in the gaps, and it's fun to say, I'm going to be true to history. And then here, even though there's a historical record, I'm just going to tweak it a little bit to make it serve my story while still being, you know, honest about where she was and what she did. And it was hard at times to actually find out what happened. You know, Deborah is not George Washington. Her every minute or day, or even frankly every year, was not well accounted for. And even the unit she was in, record keeping at West Point, was not so tight as it is now. And so her unit, you'd have the logbook for her unit missing for months at a time. And then when you found it, it would say things like, rotated through Peekskill and Tarrytown camps, saw some skirmishes. Well, that leaves me a lot of room as a novelist to say, okay, I can be true to those facts and make up around them.
Living in Washington, D.C. probably gave you a lot of places to go to find out information on her, or not necessarily, and her unit.
I actually did more research when I was living in Rhode Island, so I was a short drive from Middleborough, so I could go back and look at that area where she grew up. I drove to West Point. There's a wonderful historic site in New Windsor, New York, which is north of West Point. And that's where she spent, the whole army spent its final winter in the field, at the New Windsor Cantonment. And the men built their own huts. That was the first activity. You got to keep an army busy if they're not fighting. So they built their own huts, and I think 16 men slept in these huts. And they've built a model or a replica of them in New Windsor, and you can go inside it, and you think to yourself, my God, okay, you wouldn't want to be one of those 16 men, but you really wouldn't want to be one of those 16 men if you were actually a woman. I don't know how she did it. It's absolutely remarkable. So that was hugely helpful to see the conditions that she lived in. And other sites that they've preserved up there, the headquarters in Newburgh, where Washington spent the final winter. Deborah served General Patterson, and she also served General Knox, and Knox's headquarters are preserved. It was just invaluable to see the terrain and the sorts of houses that she would have been a servant or a soldier servant in at the time. So that was really great.
I've talked to authors that have written books on the Civil War, and of course they know where all the Civil War battles took place, and they may travel to a place that they're writing about and wake up at that 5 o'clock in the morning hour just to get a look at how everything was. When you were going across Deborah's track, when you were tracing that a little bit, which is the way it sounds, did you happened to go there, you know, maybe the barn she was in at that certain hour, just to see what maybe dusk looked like, to draw that?
It's a really good point. You know, to spend time in these places and not just drive past them and not stay on the highway, but to get out and walk and feel, how steep are these hills? What would it have felt like to walk up? Yep, I did a lot of that. I think that the Revolutionary War isn't quite as closely detailed in its records as the Civil War is. In the Civil War, we also have photographs, which I think makes it a more quote-unquote memorable war because we can actually picture it. We don't have as clear of an image of what the Revolutionary War was like, and a lot of it is guesswork. A lot of the stuff, like with West Point, as I was saying earlier, it's simply decayed. It doesn't exist anymore. There were rotational camps at Sing Sing, Peekskill, Tarrytown, all up and down the Hudson. There's not a trace of them left in most parts. You have stone and metal fortifications, but a lot of the stuff was wood and a lot of stuff was temporary. And of course, that area is heavily populated now. So it's all a lot of the historical stuff is sadly gone.
Well, if my history teacher was telling me the truth, we won this war because the soldiers did something a little different than what the British did. The British fought that gentleman war where they would stand there and take the shot, but the United States, they would hide behind things, and that's where they had their advantage.
That's the story of Lexington and Concord. I think that's very true for the early part of the war. That's what I was taught, too. And I think that was my knowledge of the American Revolution going into the research. I had no idea about the later part of the war. You know, by 1782, when Deborah enlisted, really wound down. The British were holed up in Manhattan. That was their last stronghold. And they were kind of working on the treaty over in Paris and negotiating things. And the war had really sort of ground almost to a halt. And there was just this one small theater of activity in Westchester County and very, very minor skirmishes. But they couldn't leave each other alone. So West Point would sail down and then the British would sail up. And you'd had these little groups of riders out from Manhattan who would go and raid a farm or something of the sort. Very different sort of warfare than you saw at the beginning or the middle.
Alex, if I want more information on Revolutionary, your brand new book, maybe where you're going to be during book signing tours, maybe on that next book once it's ready to come out, you have a website, I'm sure.
Yes, I do. It is alexmyerswriting.com.
And when we go there, what are we going to see?
You're going to see the cover of this book, which I love, and you'll get links to news. You can read some reviews of upcoming events. I think there's some information on me. A kind of a brief plot synopsis, the general overview stuff.
Cool. So check out that website, Revolutionary. Of course, you know, Alex said he loved the book cover. I like the feel of it, too. It's almost cloth-like, red, white, and blue. Of course, that's got to be Deborah there with her real long gun and her uniform.
That's right. That's what it's meant to evoke. A little bit of the flag. You got some stitches there. Kinda, I like how it harks back to her being a weaver with the texture, as you mentioned, and her also sewing her own uniform and sewing the men's clothes that she wore. And I think they got a lot of the themes. You have some division and some unity there as well. So it's a good cover.
Revolutionary, the brand new book by Alex Myers. I tell you what, it is. It'll pop. Go back in time during the Revolutionary War with Alex. Meet Deborah. Once you meet her, you're going to fall in love with her. And you're going to feel the pain of the trials and tribulations that she went to, and also the happy times. Alex, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Alex Myers, author of his new book, Revolutionary. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.